The reading this morning is from the second book of Samuel. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Look, we are your bone and flesh. For some time while Saul was king over us, it was you who led out Israel and brought it in. The Lord said to you, 'It is you who shall be shepherd of my people Israel, you who shall be ruler over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judea 7 years and 6 months. And at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judea 33 years. The king and his men marched to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land, who said to David, 'You will not come in here. Even the blind and the lame will turn you back,' thinking, 'David cannot come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, which is now the city of David. David had said on that day, 'Whoever would strike down the Jebusites, let him get up the water shaft to attack the lame and the blind, those whom David hates.' Therefore, it is said, 'The blind and the lame shall not come into the house.' David occupied the stronghold and named it to the city of David. David built the city around from the Millo inward. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord, the God of hosts, was with him." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. When Jesus and his disciples were approaching Jerusalem at Bethphage and Bethany near the Mount of Olives, Jesus sent two of his disciples and said to them, "Go into the village ahead of you, and immediately as you enter it, you will find tied there a colt that has never been ridden. Untie it and bring it. If anyone says to you, 'Why are you doing this?' just say, 'The Lord needs it,' and we'll send it back immediately." The disciples went away and found a colt tied near a door outside in the street. As they were untying it, some of the bystanders said to them, "What are you doing untying the colt?" They told them what Jesus had said, and they allowed them to take it. Then they brought the colt to Jesus and threw their cloaks on it, and he sat on it. Many people spread their cloaks on the road, and others spread leafy branches that they had cut in the fields. Then those who went ahead and those who followed were shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. Blessed is the coming kingdom of our ancestor David. Hosanna in the highest heaven." The Gospel of Christ.
As we've been making our way through the narrative lectionary, we've acknowledged that in order to make it to Christmas in time to get into the Gospel, there's no way we can cover all the books in the Hebrew Bible. So we've had to skip a few. But it's interesting that both the narrative lectionary in its 4-year cycle and our usual revised common lectionary in its 3-year cycle both essentially skip the book of Joshua. It's used and referred to only 3 times in the revised common lectionary and only once in the narrative lectionary. And the parts that are referred to are just at the very, very beginning and at the very end, talking about how Joshua is indeed the right guy for the job, basically, and at the end, the familiar phrase, "Choose you this day whom you will serve." Why do the narrative lectionaries, why do both lectionaries kind of skip over Joshua? And I think the reason they do is because the message of Joshua is actually rather challenging because it has to do with how it is that Israel came to occupy the promised land, how they came to have the land that is now known as Israel. And so we skipped over Joshua last week and went right to the time of the judges instead when Reverend Margaret talked about the story of Ruth. And here now we've skipped over 1 Samuel, which is about King Saul, and we're now into 2 Samuel, which is about King David. And King David is the greatest king that Israel ever had. And after Saul's reign, David now comes to the throne. And when you heard Jeff reading the scriptures this morning, we were talking about how David was acclaimed to be king. And then it said that he reigned from a city called Hebron for 7.5 years. But then he reigned from Jerusalem for 33 years. So he had a 40-year reign. And Jerusalem was the main place. And then we read about how he got Jerusalem. And what it says in a very succinct way, which is amplified a bit elsewhere, there was this city known as Jebus. And in Jebus lived the Jebusites. And David decided that he didn't want to just have Hebron as a capital, but something better, something more suitable. And so this town of Jebus was on a mountain known as Zion, and he decided that's who he wanted, that's what he wanted. So he went in and he attacked and eliminated the Jebusites so that he could take their city, rename it the City of David, and ultimately rename it Jerusalem to now become the City of Israel. And that's what we just read about in 2 Samuel chapter 5. That's how Jerusalem became the capital of Israel. Now, you've heard me say on several occasions that the Hebrew Bible started being written about 3,000 years ago in the time of the monarchy, probably in the time of David, when Israel was now settled. The kingdom had been established. There was no longer all of this warfare and conflict. They could settle down in peace and start telling their story. And of course, this is when that begins to happen. The Hebrew Bible begins to be written and compiled and edited and consolidated into its current form to tell the story of Israel and to tell them how they got there, who they were, who their God was, and how they're supposed to respond. But I think one of the themes in their writing was also to settle how it is they came to not only occupy Jerusalem, but the entire land, and even to give the justification as to why they did it that way. Because you can imagine that perhaps somebody was thinking when David attacked Jerusalem and eradicated the Jebusites, that someone might have thought, was that really a good idea? Was that the way we should have done this? It's done now. I guess we have to live with it. But the story would also help provide justification for those actions. And so to find that justification, we have to start all the way back in Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9, let me just see if I can get this microphone to stop crackling. We'll see what happens. Good luck. Genesis chapter 9 is the end of the account of Noah and the flood. And at this point, the flood has happened. Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives, 8 people, are the only human beings to survive the flood with all the animals on the ark. The floodwaters have receded, the ark has landed, and now they've come out of the ark and they're going to get life going again. And here is how we read the story. The sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. Why is that phrase there? Okay, whatever. Ham was the father of Canaan. All right, so the sons of Noah who went out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the whole earth was peopled, which makes sense, right? If Noah and his wife are no longer having kids, then everybody else is descended from Shem, Ham, and Japheth, right? Okay, so Noah, a man of the soil, was the first to plant a vineyard. He drank some of the wine and became drunk and lay uncovered in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, there it is again. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. This is an interesting little episode. I think the intention behind this is to show that nobody had ever made a wine before. And so Noah plants this vineyard, and after probably 10 years, I think that's how long it takes to get a vineyard up and running so you can actually make something, he takes some of the grapes and squishes them and gets this liquid and doesn't realize that it's now fermented and intoxicating. And so he's drinking this great juice he just made, and next thing you know, he's loopy, and he passes out naked in his tent. His youngest son, Ham, comes in to talk to his dad about whatever and sees his dad lying there and is rather amused by this situation. So he goes and tells Shem and Japheth, hey, come check out dad. He's completely lost that he's naked in his tent. Well, Shem and Japheth are horrified that Ham would be so disrespectful to his dad. So what they do is they come together shoulder to shoulder with a cloak over their shoulders and they walk in backwards so they can drape the cloak over their naked father and cover his nakedness and his shame without them observing it. And so in doing this, they were honoring Noah, whereas Ham was dishonoring Noah. Well, Noah eventually wakes up from his drunken stupor. And here's what we read. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him, probably because Shem and Japheth told him, he said, now, what do you think Noah would have to say about this? Ham has been disrespectful to him. Ham did not honor him as his father. Noah finds out. What does Noah say? Cursed be Canaan. Lowest of slaves shall he be to his brothers. He also said, blessed by Yahweh my God be Shem, and let Canaan be his slave. He says nothing about Ham. Canaan is Ham's fourth son. And Noah, for some reason, because of Ham's sinful actions towards him, decides that it must be suitable to put a curse not on Ham, and not even his firstborn son, but his fourthborn son, the one bearing the name of Canaan. Later on in chapter 10, we read about the descendants of Ham. They are Cush, which is Sudan, modern-day Sudan, Egypt, Put, which is modern-day Libya, and Canaan. There are the four sons, basically all occupying northern Africa and the Middle East. He goes on, and we find that Canaan became the father of Sidon and Heth and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Harkites, a whole bunch of other names here. Basically, the descendants of Canaan are the Canaanites, and there are several flavors of Canaanites, including one of those subdivisions being the Jebusites. The territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon, which if you can imagine the Mediterranean Sea, and we're on the east side of the Mediterranean, and you go north up between the border of Israel and Lebanon, that's roughly where Sidon is. The territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar as far as Gaza. So the Canaanites are the descendants of Canaan, who is the descendant of Ham. And when Ham disrespected Noah, Noah says, cursed be Canaan, may he be a slave to his brother Shem. The descendants of Shem, by the way, are known as the Semites and the Semitic peoples. If you are anti-Semitic, it means you're against the Jews. It means you're against Israel. And so the descendants of Canaan, whose territory extends down to Gaza, are to be the slaves of the descendants of Shem, who will ultimately be the Israelites. Now, if you read the Bible at face value, you have to take this and go, wow, Noah must have had some kind of prophetic gifting that he was able to see ahead, that even though it was his son Shem that did this disrespectful thing to him, he somehow knew that his fourth son Canaan would probably carry that same disrespectful kind of way of looking at life and pass that on successfully down through the ages through all of his descendants, because all of his descendants are the ones who are carrying that root of bitterness and disrespect and so on. And evidently, Yahweh agreed with him. Because when we get to Exodus chapter 23, Moses has given the Ten Commandments. He's now instructing the Israelites about what's supposed to happen when they go into the promised land. And speaking for Yahweh, Moses says, when my angel goes in front of you and brings to you the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Canaanites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and I blot them out, you shall not bow down or worship their gods. I will send the pestilence in front of you, which shall drive out the Hivites, the Canaanites, and the Hittites from before you. Little by little, I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and possessed the land. I will set your borders from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines. For I will hand over to you the inhabitants of the land, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them. Well, as we know, that generation of Israelites didn't want to enter the promised land, so they go and wander in the wilderness for 40 years. They die off, and now in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses is speaking to the next generation, giving them instructions about what's going to happen when they go into the land. And in Deuteronomy 7, when Yahweh your God brings you into the land that you are about to enter and occupy, and he clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and when Yahweh your God gives them over to you and you defeat them, then you must utterly destroy them. Make no covenant with them and show them no mercy. Why? Two chapters later, chapter 9. When Yahweh your God thrusts them out before you, do not say to yourself, it is because of my righteousness that Yahweh has brought me in to occupy the land. It is rather because of the wickedness of these nations that Yahweh is dispossessing them before you. It is not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you are going in to occupy this land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, Yahweh your God is dispossessing them before you in order to fulfill the promise that Yahweh made on oath to your ancestors, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And then later on in Deuteronomy chapter 20, Moses is giving instructions on how they're supposed to prosecute this military campaign. And he says there's basically two kinds of city you're going to encounter. There are just these, you know, run-of-the-mill, whatever cities that show up. And then there's the cities of the Amorites and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Canaanites and all those guys. When you encounter these cities and you want to take the city, go up and talk to them and say, hey, we're going to come and declare war on you and take your city. But instead, we could have peace if you like. Then you'll just be our slaves and then we'll still take your city. So that's the one procedure to take. The other procedure is for these people, these cities of the other nations. As for the towns of these peoples that Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance, you must not let anything that breathes remain alive. You shall annihilate them. The Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, just as Yahweh your God has commanded. And so Israel was being told, as the story goes, before they entered the promised land, that all of these peoples already living there needed to be absolutely eliminated because of their wickedness. And their wickedness, if you read the Bible at face value, goes all the way back to Ham sinning against his father Noah, and Noah cursed Canaan at that moment, and it's trickled down all the way, and Yahweh is totally cool with it. And so the book of Joshua describes how this gets carried out. Starting with Jericho, and then Ai, and then several other cities, we see Israel prosecuting this campaign to take the promised land. There are times that they don't kill everybody in the city, and then Yahweh gets mad at them for not doing that, and some Israelites end up dying because they disobeyed Yahweh. And so then they repent, and then they finish the job, and then things are better. So the book of Joshua, I would suggest to you, is avoided in the narrative, because it is really, really difficult to reconcile this thread of their story in any way that is palatable for us today. But if you just take it at face value, what else can you conclude? How much plainer can it be? Well, one way to look at it is to say, you know, there's a different way to understand why this was written down this way. Could it be that this is actually what Yahweh wanted Israel to do? Or is it more likely that when Israel started compiling its story after its kingdom was established, part of their purpose in writing their backstory was to write the justification they had for how they occupied the land and how David could be justified in taking out the Jebusites and taking their city and making it his capital, Jerusalem, instead? What I'm saying here is the Israelites said that Yahweh told them to kill them off. But I would suggest to you that they were mistaken. And I would say that on the basis of what Jesus has said. Now, we read from the gospel, we talked about the triumphal entry, and the reason for getting that little portion of the scriptures there is because when Jesus comes into Jerusalem, the celebration about Jesus coming in includes this idea that we have this descendant of King David coming on our throne, and they're excited because they're expecting that this king, just like David, would do to the Romans exactly what David did to the Jebusites and also to the Philistines and the others who still remained in the land. But Jesus wasn't that kind of person. Jesus instead said, by the way, this is Jesus' backstory. This is what Jesus would have learned as he was growing up as a kid. This is what all the people Jesus talked to would have been understanding and believing. And Jesus said to them, "You have heard that it was said, 'Love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemy and do good to those that harm you." Jesus talks about the opposite thing to what was the common narrative to everybody living in Israel in his day. He said, this is the wrong idea. You guys got the wrong idea about God. You're thinking in this direction, but that's not the way it goes. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, don't go with this tit for tat, gotta get vengeance kind of thing. Instead, we look for forgiveness and grace and mercy and love, and we move away from this narrative that is saying that somehow it is God's will for us to kill off other people in his name. King Saul, who preceded David, did battle famously against the Ammonites, and the Philistines. And it's during this period of time that we get the famous story of David and Goliath, where David, as a young man, takes out this giant who is the champion of the Philistines, and by killing him, defeated the Philistines in that particular battle. And then David later will deal with the Philistines. The name of the Philistines, the earliest form we have of it, was an Egyptian term sometime earlier, which sounds a lot like Philistine, but they're speaking Egyptian, so it doesn't sound exactly like it. The word Philistine is a Hebrew word, and then in the 5th century, the 400s BCE, Herodotus, the Greek historian, calls them what is the root word for Palestinians. And as you read the Bible, you will find that there are 5 key cities that the Philistines possess. One of them is Gaza. Another one is Ashkelon, a name you've heard about in the last couple of weeks. Ashdod is a third one. There's a couple others. All of them except one are in Israel now today. But the land of the Philistines, the land of the Palestinians, who are now culturally different than they were in the biblical times, but still, we hear about them in the news all the time today. And when we hear about what's going on in the Middle East right now, we are disturbed, as we ought to be, for what we see happening. 2 weeks ago, we were shocked to hear that Hamas launched its attack into Israel and began indiscriminately killing civilians, men, women, and children, taking some of them hostage, doing these terrorist acts as they are trying to deal with the bone to pick they have with Israel. And then, of course, we've seen Israel's response to the attack on Hamas and their response in the Gaza Strip. Let me give a little bit of context to what we're dealing with here. The Gaza Strip is really small. 2.6 million people live in it. Now, if you were to take Calgary to get an idea, the Gaza Strip is 40 kilometers long. So if you go to the northeast corner of the Ring Road, and then it goes straight down the east side of town to the southeast corner, that's 30 kilometers. So if you add 5 kilometers north to Balzac and 5 kilometers south to just south of the South Health Campus, you've got the 40-kilometer length of the Gaza Strip. The width of the Gaza Strip is irregular, but it is roughly an average of 10 kilometers. That will take you from the Ring Road to McLeod Trail. And so that rectangular stretch is what Gaza is. Can you imagine Twice as many people as living that live in Calgary. Twice as many people as the population of Calgary living in that area. And those in the north near the city of Gaza, which is just simply a portion of that narrow strip of land, are told, you know, just evacuate, just head south. Where are they going to fit? But Israel is saying, we're going to be attacking you and retaliating for what you did to us. And right now, as far as the body count is concerned, about 1,400 Israelis have been killed in the initial assault that Hamas had done, and about 4,300 Palestinians have died in Israel's response. And we have to understand a couple things. First of all, the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip, many of them are Muslim, many of them are Christians. And most of them do not support Hamas. Hamas does not represent them. Hamas just happens to be the group that is in charge. Just like in Afghanistan, after the Canadian forces and others left Afghanistan, the Taliban took power again. And most of the people living in Afghanistan are not happy that the Taliban is their government, but what are you going to do? The Taliban is in charge of Afghanistan. Hamas is in charge of Gaza, even though the residents of the Gaza Strip are not all in support of Hamas. And part of the challenge that we face today is that Hamas's reason for existence, being an Islamic fundamentalist extremist terrorist group, it exists in order to eradicate Israel. That's why it exists. We want Israel to be blown off the map. And we are horrified to hear them say that. And yet, as for the towns of these peoples that Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance, O Israel, you must not let anything that breathes remain alive. You shall annihilate them. The word of the Lord. For those who are motivated by the religious history that is talked about in the Hebrew Bible, which Muslims pay attention to as well, by the way, for those who are motivated by the scriptural account, taking it at face value and just going with it because that's what it says, both sides feel that they have a God-given responsibility to eliminate the other. Because after all, Yahweh said this land belongs to Israel. Even though the Canaanites and Hivites and Perizzites and Jebusites and the Philistines were there before them, Yahweh said it belongs to us. And Yahweh said we have to kill everybody because they're so wicked. And then we take possession of the land. Hamas would say that Allah is the one who is saying, no, these people are interlopers. They are the evil ones. You need to get rid of them. And as long as there is this religiously motivated background to both sides in this conflict, it is going to be nigh unto impossible to see peace ever emerge. Now, I don't have time to go into the details, but over the past 150 years in that region, there are simply strictly political reasons for there to be a conflict as well. And many people who have a secular perspective, who don't care what the scriptures say, also have their very good reasons on both sides for thinking why they ought to get rid of the other. We just don't have time to get into that today. But I just want to deal with this religious background. What does this matter for us? We have to recognize that we need to be careful how we read the scriptures. Because if we just read this at face value, and just say, yeah, Noah said that, and Yahweh definitely said that, and Yahweh called for the absolute destruction, elimination, and annihilation of these peoples at the hands of his people, then what else can we conclude but think that that's the way it's got to be? But when we look at what Jesus taught, Jesus says, no, that's not the way it's supposed to be. You got it wrong. We happen to have an account of what Israel was thinking and what Israel said and how Israel was justifying itself in this area, saying, here is how we came to have this kingdom. But that doesn't mean that they were correct in saying that Yahweh told them to do it. They said that Yahweh told them to do it. And I would argue that with Jesus, no, he didn't. Now, what does that do for your approach to the scriptures? How do we handle that? Yeah, that's a big question, isn't it? Absolutely it is, and something worth further discussion. But even still, having made that observation, what does this really still come down to for us to handle? Well, let me say this. There's nothing we can do about what's going on in the Middle East right now. Yes, we can pray, we can intercede, we can ask God to see peace come. But what I mean by saying there's nothing we can do is I'm saying there's nothing we can do to influence the diplomatic activities in the Middle East or the lack thereof. There's nothing we can do to halt the war or anything. We can't. So what do we learn from this at least 3,000-year-old story of conflict? Well, what we realize is if Jesus is right, and it shouldn't have played out that way and shouldn't still play out this way, then we have to embrace what Jesus is saying. And if things get to the point where nations can have hatred towards one another, does it not make sense that we ensure that we do not, in our own personal lives, come anywhere close to seeing that kind of thing happen? I'm not saying you're going to declare war on your neighbor. But if you've got a neighbor who's a challenge to work with, Jesus would say, your role is not to look for ways to get back at your neighbor. Your role is not to figure out how to take revenge on your neighbor. Your role is to figure out how to love your neighbor, how to do good to them, even if they don't like you very much. Jesus would say that the importance of what we need to do as individuals is to ensure that our lives are exhibiting a tendency towards reconciliation, towards grace, towards compassion and generosity and love, that if we as individuals live that way, then a collection of us can never get to the solution that would ultimately be resolved by violence, whether military action or terrorism or just simply fighting one another. It's not an easy message to live. It's far easier for us to be at odds with others. It's far easier for us to get ticked off at what people say and hold grudges. But Jesus is calling us to put those notions aside and get rid of any notion that somehow they're justifiable. Now, having said that, let me explain that I understand, and I don't know how I would respond if somebody killed one of my kids, for example, and how ready would I be to forgive or to be gracious to the person who did that. I cannot tell you how I would respond. It would be tremendously difficult to try to follow in that way. But Jesus is saying that unless we work in that direction, and let that be our modus operandi, let that be the way that we conduct ourselves normally, we're not going to see the kingdom of heaven on earth. We're not going to see peace and harmony between people. We're just going to see more of this. And we're seeing it today. So with this rather difficult sermon to preach, some of you might be horrified at how I've interpreted the Bible today. Well, that'd be important for us to talk about at some point if you are. Let's get together, let's have coffee, let's talk about that, you know? Because if you happen to take the view that every word in the Bible is though it came from the very mouth of God, I just said it didn't, and that's going to cause a challenge for you. And so, yeah, we need to talk about that. If you think that my words are anti-Semitic because I'm not coming across as somebody who's just pro-Israel, let me just suggest that you can disagree with what a country is doing without saying that you hate that country or are opposed to them. The international community is trying to say to the Israelis, exercise restraint in your response, calling them to hold off on bulldozing the Gaza Strip. But that's not anti-Semitism. That's just saying, think about the innocent people in the Gaza Strip before you just go and try to murder Hamas. Yes, Hamas was murderous towards you, But I mean, it's not anti-Semitism. It's saying, how can we resolve this in a better way? And maybe you need help to think about, how do I live in a way that I am gracious to people by default, rather than looking for reasons to get back at someone who has treated me incorrectly? Jesus did say that the way that leads to life is narrow, and few find it. And it can be a difficult path And this is definitely an example of how that might be. But it is nevertheless our calling. How can we be people that exhibit the qualities of the kingdom that Jesus has talked about, that Jesus has emphasized, that Jesus highlights even over against what the common understanding of what the Hebrew Bible was saying in these areas? That is our task, and it's not easy. But let's be about doing that. Amen.